Ladies and gentlemen, welcome.
Please note that while I am a mental health professional and educator of this podcast and the information shared within it, I intended solely for information, education, and entertainment purposes. The content discussed does not constitute therapy, counseling, or any form of professional mental health services. It should not be used as a substitute for therapy or personalized mental health treatment. If you are in need of support, please consult with a licensed therapist or appropriate healthcare professional. Hello, and welcome back to Project I Am's Mentoring Moments, the space where counseling students and emerging professionals come to learn, grow, and stay connected to the evolving field of mental health counseling. I'm your host, Dr. David Schloss, and today we're diving into something I am incredibly passionate about: emerging trends in mental health counseling. We'll be exploring where we are now, where we are headed, and how you as a counseling student can adapt, prepare, and even lead in these exciting times. We'll touch on telehealth, AI in therapy, psychedelic-assisted treatment, and wellness coaching. Plus, we'll look at new ethical considerations, legislation, and what the media is saying about all of this. So buckle up, we're in for quite a ride. Let's start with something that has really become quite a permanent fixture since the COVID-19 pandemic, and that is telehealth counseling. Before 2020, telehealth was an option, but today it's often a necessity. A 2023 study published in the Journal of Counseling and Development found that over 75% of counselors provide some form of telehealth services. That was written by Perron et al. In 2023. And truth is that clients really appreciate this convenience. Counselors are expanding their reach to rural and underserved populations, breaking down geographic and mobility barriers. And that's in a report from Medicare Services. And so even in my private practice, I used to have an office and I closed it during COVID. And when I reopened my office, only two of them wanted to return to in-person. And if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Your therapist is a 45-minute drive away, you have an hour session, and you have a 45-minute drive back. That's 2.5 hours out of your day. And the truth is that many people don't have 2.5 hours in the middle of their afternoon to take off work to go to counseling. And not many counselors offer evening hours or weekend hours. And so setting aside 1 hour and having counseling via telehealth for many people is a lot more convenient. But with this opportunity, there comes some additional responsibility. In 2024, the ACA Code of Ethics emphasized informed consent, privacy, and competency in telehealth platforms. Make sure that you are trained not only in your therapeutic modality, but also in your platform's security settings. And so that's also an additional responsibility for us, right? Whatever platform it is you're using for telecounseling, you know, whether it's Zoom or any other kind of modality, any other kind of platform that allows you to use video, find out, is it HIPAA compliant? Usually, if it's a paid service where you have to pay for it, there is a HIPAA option to it. So make sure that you can speak to that and that that is in your informed consent. One big shift is the Interstate Counseling Compact. Now, that compact is gaining incredible traction. As of early 25 this year, 34 states have enacted legislation to join the compact. 34 states. That's incredible, and this allows licensed counselors to practice across state lines, and I think that's a brilliant idea. There are a number of states that obviously have not signed on to the counseling compact, Texas being one of them, but maybe one day, cross your fingers, right? This makes telehealth even more accessible, and part of the reason this is so important is because there are certain people, certain licensed professionals with specialty skills that focus on particular areas and are experts in those areas that aren't easily accessible, that maybe live in another state, and people need access to those counselors. So this counseling compact, This makes telehealth even more accessible, but you still need to understand state laws and your practice scopes. So, how to prepare for this? Take telehealth training. Many universities now offer certifications, and you can find it elsewhere online as well. Develop strong online engagement skills. Online engagement is a little different from in-person work. There's some things that you need to be aware of and you need to be careful of. Stay on top of HIPAA laws, particularly ones that involve new technologies. And so with so much of my counseling being online, there's certain things that I've become aware of that have been challenging for me. And one of the things has been making sure that my other screens are closed and that my Do Not Disturb is on. Because what happens is I'm chatting with a client and one of my other screens, I notice an email come up or a text come up. And in my mind, I'm going, is that from a client? Are they canceling the next session, which is, you know, in just a little while? Is somebody experiencing an emergency? Typical things that, you know, want to try get my interest and have me look. Or one of my kids texting me and part of me is wondering, is it urgent? Is everything okay? And I feel so tempted to look at the other screen. But it's those movements, that kind of distraction, that in a space like telehealth on your screen is so easily noticed and can cause a breach in rapport. And just because your client doesn't say anything about it in the moment doesn't mean that they don't notice or that it doesn't bother them. So be aware of that, right? Secondly, let's talk about AI in therapy, a topic that stirs up a lot of excitement as well as many ethical concerns. So where is AI now at the moment? Well, there are plenty of AI tools like Wobot and Wiser that offer text-based support and cognitive behavioral strategies. So AIs are really good with particular modalities. The more manualized a modality is, the easier it is for AI to use that modality. In the classes I teach, I've shown students particular AI modalities that are out there and how they work. And some of them are really good at reflections. I've also shown one or two when I've been challenged regarding an AI's ability to communicate empathy. And I have one AI that I show that I created for myself that I'll have a discussion with it and I will talk about particular things and I'll have the AI respond and I'll do this in front of the class and I'll say to them, even though I know in my mind that this is an AI, that this is an algorithm, and a computer program can't show empathy, the truth is, with some of these responses, because they're so personalized, I feel empathy. I feel that empathy is being communicated, right? So in my knowledge, in my rational self, I know it's not, but in my emotional self, something does happen. And so that's an interesting thing. And for those of you that have never experienced that with an AI, there are some AIs that are worth trying out that are looking at because I think these are things that we need to be aware of. The American Psychiatric Association predicts that AI could assist in clinical decision-making and diagnosis by 2030. Isn't that interesting? Also, these AI tools, maybe they aren't all substitutes for therapy, but they can supplement mental health care by offering 24/7 availability and helping with psychoeducation. What are some of the ethical considerations that we need to be aware of? The ACA's 2024 guidelines stress client autonomy and informed consent where AI is concerned. Clients need to know if AI is supporting assessment or recommendations. And I think that's really good. And so many of us, you know, if you're out there and you've been practicing for a while, you might not have updated your informed consent if you're using AI in any form or fashion. So if you are, you probably need to update your informed consent. And for students that are just graduating now, you need to be aware of including informed consent regarding AI use. So make sure that you have that in there. Plus, there's also a need for algorithm transparency. We have to ask, how is the client's data being used? Where is the client data being stored? Is the AI program we're using HIPAA compliant? And also, is the AI culturally competent? A recent New York Times article that came out in 2024 highlighted bias in AI algorithms, particularly concerning racial and gender representation. So there's a lot of work to do in this area, and there is upcoming legislation. In the United States, the AI Accountability Act is under review. If passed, it will require rigorous oversight for AI tools used in healthcare, and this is from Congress 2024. So how can you and I prepare? Well, familiarize yourself with AI tools. Try them out. See how you feel about them. There are some that are incredibly useful, but use them ethically. Secondly, stay informed on legislation and ethics. NBCC gave some recent updates regarding ethics and AI. ACA is continuously updating their ethics with regards to AI. Stay abreast of those kind of things and consider how AI might augment your practice and not replace the human relationship. I know it's exciting, and I think rather than being afraid of AI and resisting it, holding it at arm's length, figure out a way to use AI, but to use it ethically. AI isn't going anywhere, and the pace at which it is evolving is incredible. It is exponential, right? And so things are landing on our doorstep. New tools, new programs are arriving on our doorstep all the time. So make sure you're aware of it and use it to your advantage, but use it ethically. Another growing field that has been around for, you know, quite a while over the last 5 to 10 years is psychedelic assisted therapy. Psychedelic assisted therapy might feel fringe to some, but to some others, we understand that it is rapidly growing and moving into the mainstream. In the last 4 years, I have had opportunity to consult for 3 AI companies. For one of them, I was a director of psychology and training. And what I did for them was I helped write the meditations that assisted with people's psychedelic experience. And so we would write a meditation, we would put it to music, and it would be focused on PTSD or stress reduction, anxiety or depression. There was a whole range of them that we would use. We would use about 4 to 5 meditations per stream, you know, per area. And that's what I helped them do. And I also helped with some training. And then for another company, I also did some meditations. And so these companies are being run by entrepreneurs who are seeing the need and are stepping out there on the cutting edge, developing these things, right? So there's a huge advance in this area. And some therapists that are well acquainted with ketamine therapy and psychedelic assisted therapy, they are deep in it. They've joined Journey Medical. They've joined not Vivia Mind that closed down. They've joined Mindbloom. They've joined a bunch of these other companies, and they are deep in it and helping their clients have this type of therapy. Some of them are working in clinics where there's IV ketamine therapy happening. And so that is something that you need to be aware of that might be beneficial for your client, but you do need to know more about it. A landmark 2023 psychiatric study by JAMA found that MDMA-assisted therapy is really effective in treating PTSD, and it leads to significant symptom reduction in over 70% of participants. You can find that in Michelle et al. 2023. Now, psilocybin, that has also been shown to reduce treatment-resistant depression and existential anxiety in terminal patients, Davis et al. 2021. So those are out there and they are being used, right? But those are only being used in particular states where ketamine is being used, I don't want to say everywhere, but it's being used a lot in the majority of states. Now, regarding the legal status, Oregon and Colorado have legalized psilocybin-assisted therapy under strict guidelines, and the FDA has granted breakthrough therapy designation for both psilocybin and MDMA. And by doing this, they are fast-tracking research and potential approval. But there are also ethical considerations that we need to understand about these things. the ACA and the NBCC remind us that this work requires specialized training. Competency is critical, and ethical codes demand that we practice within the scope of our competence. So if this is something that you want to get involved in, here's how you can prepare. Look for certification programs such as MAPS or MDMA. Understand set and setting, as well as integration therapy techniques. Also, stay informed on state laws. Right now, jurisdiction varies widely from state to state. And I just want to give an example of why we need training if we're going to be doing this type of therapy. Think of an example where somebody is receiving ketamine-assisted therapy via IV, and the therapist is in the room with them. Imagine a setting where somebody is receiving intravenous ketamine therapy with a therapist in the room with them. The client has their eyes closed with a blindfold, there is gentle music in the background, there is a drip attached to them, and they are receiving the ketamine. And as they go under and begin to have this psychedelic experience, the therapist says, "What do you see?" And the client says, I see this person standing over me. I think it's my dad," which is an interesting comment, right? It doesn't mean anything besides the fact that they're seeing their dad standing over them. A therapist that has not been trained in psychedelic assisted therapy might very innocently ask something like, "Are you scared?" Right? Asking that question immediately inserts a suggestion into that client's mind while they are in this very suggestive state. And if they weren't scared, they might very well become scared. And so the importance of reflecting, of open-ended questions, of asking, "What do you see now? Tell me what is happening now," and staying away from any kind of directive work is super important. And so the need for training in this area is huge. Otherwise, there's a risk of significant harm. And the last area we're going to look at today is the rise of wellness coaching. Wellness coaching is transforming how we view holistic mental health. And there's a significant trend here. The Global Wellness Institute estimates that the wellness market is worth $5.6 trillion globally. Now, what is wellness coaching? Wellness coaching focuses on preventive care, goal setting, and behavioral change. It often includes nutrition, exercise, and mindfulness practices. And there's a place for it, absolutely. And it does overlap with counseling to some degree. You see, the ethical question that this raises is this. The ACA reminds us that counseling and coaching are distinct professions. Counselors are bound by licensure, confidentiality, and evidence-based practice, while coaching itself remains largely unregulated. Now, the Wild West of coaching is possibly going to come to an end as it becomes more regulated. Some states are considering licensing wellness coaches. Massachusetts, for example, has a proposed bill to regulate coaching standards by 2026. And this was mentioned in the Massachusetts state legislature in 2025, very recently. So how can we prepare for this? Well, define your scope of practice clearly. If you are a counselor that also provides coaching, make sure that your clients understand the difference between the two and what they're signing up for, and outline this in your informed consent. Consider additional certifications, such as ones through the National Board for Health and Wellness Coaching. Also, market yourself ethically, honoring the distinction between coaching and therapy. I think another challenge with this that I've experienced when I have worked with a client for coaching in particular is coaching is all about helping people achieve particular goals in a certain amount of time. For example, I want to write this book, I want to finish it within 6 months, and I need you as a coach to help hold me accountable, set goals and action steps to help me reach my goals, which wellness coaches can very much do. The challenge, though, is that underneath people's inability to reach their goals are oftentimes issues that require counseling. I think the overlap between counseling and coaching can be very murky. And I think oftentimes coaches end up providing a little bit of counseling, even if not intentionally. In my personal opinion, I think counselors can do coaching, but coaches can't do counseling. Something to be aware of. So where do we go to from here? As counseling students and new professionals, you are stepping into a world that is technologically advanced, ethically complex, but also incredibly exciting. So here are a few takeaways. Stay informed. Don't bury your head in the sand. Read the research, follow the news, and engage in continuing education. Prioritize ethics. New tools, as wonderful as they are, bring new dilemmas. Stay grounded in your ethical codes. Every time there's a new advancement, something new comes along that can benefit clients, ask yourself, are there ethics that speak to this new thing that you want to use? Lastly, embrace lifelong learning, whether it's telehealth, AI, psychedelics, or coaching. The field is definitely evolving at a rapid pace, but the good news is that you can evolve too. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you for joining me today on Project I Am Mentoring Moments. Don't forget to subscribe, leave a review, and share this episode with your fellow counseling students and new professionals. Don't forget that every month we have Mentoring Moments Live, which is a Zoom session for students across the country that want to build community, access new resources, and just stay in touch with one another. Until next time, keep growing. And don't forget that you add value to the counseling profession and to the healing community as a whole. May you be well.
Today will be glorious. Put on your sunglasses, sunscreen, and sun smiles. You're going to love it.